committee.
Hearing none, committee is completed business. We'll move on to the regulations committee.
Okay. First order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval? Moved by Commissioner Popham, second by Brown. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Item number one,
Landon Waterfront Update, Mr. Smith. Thank you, sir. I'd like to update you on the 53rd Texas Gene Work Academy began on October 1st, 2007, with 41 cadets. 15 of these cadets are funded with general revenue approved by the 71st legislature, as we mentioned this morning. The class is the most diverse in many years and expected to graduate in May of 2008. Note that two of the cadets have dropped out since the inception of this class of cadets, leaving 39 active cadets at this time. The law enforcement division now occupies and maintains the new Gene Morgan Academy site in Hamilton County. Fundraising for major construction projects continues, and a consultant has been selected to begin the design process for the campus. Meanwhile, the division is preparing existing facilities in Hamilton County for use in ongoing training exercises for game wardens from across the state. President George W. Bush signed an executive order on October the 22nd, 2007, to protect red drum and striped bass, two game fish that are popular in Texas. The order prohibits the sale of striped bass and red drum caught in federal waters, encourages periodic federal stock assessments of the species, and directs federal agencies to work and state officials, quote, to find innovative ways to help conserve striped bass and red drum populations, including the use of state designation of game fish, where appropriate, to prohibit commercial sales of the fish. Texas has long been a leader in the conservation of red drum, popularly known as redfish. Red drum were declared game fish by the Texas legislature in 1981. When the commercial sale was prohibited. TPWD outlawed the use of gill nets in state waters in 1985. The first red drum fingerlings were stocked in 1983, and about 30 billion are now stocked each year in Texas bays. As a result, populations of red drum have doubled, and significantly larger fish are being caught. So we think that the president's order is good and supportive. Follows the trend we've been on, and we look forward to even better. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Committee item number two, 2008-2009 statewide hunting and fishing proclamation preview. And you're up.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. My name is Ken Sadowski. I'm with the Fisheries Division. And today I will be going over some of the potential changes we have in our freshwater fishing regulations. Just to give you a brief recap of our process, our district colleges and all the resource divisions work year-round collecting information on our resource. But they develop proposals based on that information or input from the public desiring better angling. They develop these proposals. Whole meeting within their region of the state. We have a statewide meeting in August to discuss those with all our colleges. We present those before the Freshwater Fisheries Advisory Board in October, and we discuss those with team and staff, center division, also involve other divisions within the agency, such as law enforcement and state parks. And to get to where we are today, the first proposal that we have is on a Ladybird Lake that's formerly known as Pound Lake here, which recently changed in honor of Mr. Johnson, who was instrumental in creating a lot of the parks around that lake. Right here within the Austin city limits, it has, because of the hike and bike trail, it has excellent bank access. It doesn't have restricted boat access in that no gasoline motors can be used on the lake. You can't use those route motors. It's in recent years it has documented catches of large common carp, and it's become a known destination around Texas, or the country, and even the world for carp anglers. That's resulted in a couple of major carp fishing tournaments down there in 2000 and 2006. And the result of one of those tournaments, the tournament winner would catch a state record carp during that tournament and receive $250,000. And this particular gentleman did. He ended up producing that carp with 43 pounds. So that was a pretty good way to earn some money. Because of this upsurge in popularity of the carp fishing in town lake and our interest in promoting this any sort of any new type of fishing that would have interest our anglers, we've developed a proposal to maybe assist that fishery in that lake. We're proposing a limited batting limit for common carp, and what that would consist of would be no limit to the daily bag for fish of under 33 inches, except for fish of 33 inches and over, only one of those can be retained each day. We're kind of designating it as a trophy size. There was a research done by a fisheries researcher that looked at all these freshwater fishes and to try and designate a trophy size, and he set most of those around 75-76% of the world record length. And for carp, that works out to be about 32 inches, so that seems to be a good starting point for our conversations on that. So once again, to recap, that all the carp below 33 inches could be harvested, and only one over 33 inches could be harvested, and we're not protecting all the carp data from harvest. That's not our intent. And some of the potential benefits we see of that is will help increase publicity for the trophy carp fishing in Texas and Lady Bird Lake. It also will help promote carp fishing as an untapped opportunity, especially for bank anglers in urban areas. Lake Austin also has good carp fishing, lakes up in the Dallas, Fort Worth area, other places like that. People that have something to walk down to a bank with a pole and fish for carp. A lot of people don't really know about that, but that's something that's been available for years, and we're certainly interested in promoting that within Texas. And it does have, hopefully, would protect some of those large trophy carp that bring all those anglers from around the country and around the world. And I don't think it will really have any visible increase in the overall abundance of the carp population in the region. Another, sticking with sort of a theme on urban areas, we have a community fishing lake definition in our rules. And that consists of all impoundments 75 acres or less that are totally within the city limits or a public park, and it also includes all impoundments of any size within the boundaries of the state park. We have some, because of this definition, special regulations on those waters. We have a different limit from statewide on catfish. We have no size limit in a five fish bag, and we restrict angling, pole and line angling only. Our reasons for that is some of these reservoirs, we stock catfish. A number of them are stocking catchable type catfish, and we would like to have as many anglers as possible get an opportunity to catch those fish. By restricting the angling there and also reducing the bag limit, we're trying to spread that out, that fishing opportunity out to many new anglers as possible, hopefully entice some new anglers. What we're proposing there is limiting the number of poles or lines anglers can actively fish in those waters to only two. We will omit state park lakes from this particular regulation. And this is some response to concerns raised by staff that noticed when during stocking events, anglers would go into an area, set out 10, 15 poles in an area, and especially in areas where there's limited bang bags, so they could monopolize the area and prevent other anglers from getting at that water to fish. And that's sort of contrary to what we're trying to promote there. So we hope that'll be a little more equitable distribution of that fishing enjoyment and success. As the rules are now, an angler can set up to 100 hooks, which could be 100 lines. So we're hoping this will maybe alleviate some of those problems as we continue to go into some of the urban areas and stock catchable size fish. We have a proposed change on Lake Nacogdoches. That's a surface water fly reservoir a little bit east of the city of Nacogdoches, primarily a largemouth bass fishery, but that's on crappie and catfish, and currently it has a 14 to 21 inch plot limit for the largemouth bass. We're thinking about implementing a newer regulation for us there, which would be a 16 inch maximum length limit, which means anglers could harvest fish below 16 inches, above 16 inches there wouldn't be any harvest. And we would maintain the 5 fish daily bag for those fish under 16 inches. What we do is to allow anglers to temporarily retain any of those larger fish, and we're going to sort of peg that at 24 inches or larger. If they do have a live well, and if they have a scale on board, they'd be able to retain those fish, get a weight, contact us, and donate them hopefully to the Share Lunker program or possibly for a state record. They're very interesting. So even though we will not allow actual harvest below 16 inches, we would allow some temporary possession of those fish if they were larger. And we also would like to implement that little piece of the temporary retaining of fish on Purvis Creek State Park Lake and Lake Raven and Huntsville State Park, which have a total catch and release carp. What we're hoping to accomplish there is to provide some additional protection to bass greater than 21 inches. Hopefully allow weeks to increase the trophy size fish, including those 13-pound share lumpy size fish, and also by allowing a little bit more harvest of those fish under 16 inches will decrease intraspecific competition and improve the growth rate in that reservoir. We have a small change on Lake Texoma. We currently have an exception there to our statewide limit of 14-inch minimum length limit for spotted bass. We want to move that back to the statewide limit, which is no length limit, and retain the 5-fish bag. Oklahoma is proposing a similar change, and we usually work closely with them to try and keep the regulations the same on each side of the reservoir, so it's a good change in our view. We'll remove one of our exceptions and move the limit for spotted bass back to our state license. We have a couple changes to one of our red drum regulations in fresh water, where we're stocking red drums in the reservoirs around the state. One of those was Lake Nasworthy. Due to some changes there in the operation of the reservoir, we go on to reduce it to stock red drum in there. We have some special regulations on that reservoir. We're going to remove those. And similarly on Lake Colorado City, due to golden algae and also change in operation of the reservoir, we will no longer stock red drum in that reservoir. So we're removing the special regulation on that, and both of those reservoirs will just revert to the statewide limits, which is the limit that everyone's familiar with on the coast, which is the 28th reverse spot, as you like to call it, fresh water with three fish back. That's all the changes that we're considering at this time. If you have any regular questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Questions? Discussion? Thanks again. Larry McKinney.
Chairman and members of the record, I'm Aaron King, Director of Coastal Fisheries and Bass, and Robin Rodriguez is our Director of Science and Policy to join me. Robin has been our representative on the Gulf Fisheries Council and has been our chairman for we have some questions, or if I can answer them. Our upcoming issues are really a set of three. First of all, there's a consistency issue with federal regulations. The National Marine Fisheries Service highly migratory species rule, dealing with sharks, they want to put some limits on those in terms of the populations. And we've commented on that as well. And one of the key proposals that we have some concern with is that there are a number of sharks that need to be protected, but in order to try to make sure of have concerns over identification issues, they've included other sharks as well. One of those shark species is a blackfish, which is a kind of the basis of our shark fishery here in the population is in good shape, so we're concerned they would include that in prohibitedness when the basis of the fishery, so we're looking at that. As far as scoping issues that we'd be dealing with, we would we look at increasing current minimum size limits for the shark and creating a prohibited shark list of sharks you could not take because ours are going to be And another area that we're dealing with the feds is Medicare and Fishery Service has an interim rule in place which basically in there in the federal waters has a two fish bag limit and a season of 122 days. In state waters, within 9 miles, we have four bag fish limit and no close season. The Medicare and Fisheries regional director has sent me a letter asking us in all states to make our state regulations consistent with those federal regulations. And of course, we have some concern about that, but we want to put that on the table and get some input from our anglers as to what they feel. And also, we'll hear more on this issue from the National Fisheries Service about what action they might take if you don't comply. So we want to be ready to respond to that and have it open to the state.
What are the resource issues? I guess we're going to be looking into that a little bit, but in terms of sustainability of snapper, are there resource issues or scientific issues?
Well, the snapper has been in an overfishing overfished condition for quite some time, actually since the early 1980s, and we're still undergoing overfishing, and we're in overfished status. And of course, that's one of their concerns is that by Florida at this time had their state waters open and haven't complied, and we haven't complied, and by doing so, they're afraid we're jeopardizing some of the rebuilding schedules. Now, specifically in state waters, our stocks are looking pretty good. We're seeing increasing trends in recruitment and some of the other actions that we've taken, such as a closure, a shrimp closure, and so forth, have aided our stocks, and while we haven't complied exactly with the rule, we may have had greater conservation benefits than they would have had with those rules. So that's one of the things we've been telling them all along.
So as we learn more about some of the actions that may take, I mean, there are several things they could preempt state regulations as a possibility, although they've never done that anywhere, but that's certainly a possibility. Other issues they could simply close the snapper fishery in the federal waters and do something. So regardless of that, we want to put it on the table so that as we learn the consequences, our anglers can look at it. The impacts one way or the other.
What do you think the two-bag limit will do to our snapper fishing in state waters?
Certainly if you talk to charter boats and party boats and people who run those kinds of businesses, they believe that will drastically reduce their businesses. We've seen in macro and other fisheries when you take these bag limit reductions that people actually fairly quickly adjust. But it's certainly been our caution because of those local businesses and local communities that depend on that fishery that we've tried to maintain the four fish bag and we've tried to maintain our season being open year round at this point in time.
It's an important tourist fishery. I mean for everyone, but certainly for the local.
You mentioned other instances where you have restricted they have adjusted.
For instance, we're now at a two fish bag for king mackerel, and many of the same arguments were played out when king mackerel went to two fish. Certainly in other parts of the country where you have very restricted bags and seasons, you've seen those same kind of arguments play out. And certainly I can't deny that it wouldn't have some impact. I believe it would have some impact. And again, that's why we've taken the actions that we've taken, or y'all taken the actions y'all taken in the past, to maintain the season year-round and to keep the four fish bag at its current bag.
Another area dealing with the mid-season harvest within the state water, there's a proposal to limit that or to eliminate that, not to take that. Right now, in the Gulf of Mexico, the landings total 1.2 billion pounds, primarily from Louisiana waters. Texas accounts for about 3% of those landings. When you look at the last assessment of the stock, the mid-season stock, it wasn't in good condition. In our state waters, it's in good shape as well. But what we're talking about here really is a policy type issue. As pressure comes to bear on that fishery on the East Coast and others that either capture or close down parts of it, we're going to see a is a shift that fishery ends up into the Gulf, and more of our menhaden would be going to a commercial portion of that. And so it's a decision. It's what's the most valuable use of menhaden to support our recreational fishery, which is the keystone to our otherwise. And so contemplating this is a policy action to step forward now and say, we may want to make that decision now to reserve this fishery to support recreational fishery where the economic returns are greater. That's something that we want to put on the table for our anglers to talk about it in front of you all. Other states have taken action, Florida in 95 and Alabama in 2003, for example. The last item is a certification of saltwater guide. One of the guide associations have talked to this from time to time and come back and put on the table to ask us to help them raise the level of professionalism in their profession. This is not some regulatory action we're taking. We want to take advantage of the scoping process to lay this proposal out from this one guide's organization to others to see what the support might be for that. Because certainly we want to make sure that our customer, our constituents, when they hire a guide, that they're getting someone that's, you know, competent and has all the training, all the certifications that they need. And this would be a way of coming up with a process to do that. We would help them go through the certification process and make sure they can get them involved.
It's all voluntary.
We anticipate beginning. We wouldn't do it without the support of the guys. I mean, it's their proposal, and we think it's a good idea. We want to help them out with it. So we'll put that on the table. So, and that concludes.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Okay. Thank you both very much. Hi, Berger.
Good afternoon, members. I'm Mike Murphy, Director of Law and Legal. Here to talk about what we're thinking about for the upcoming season. First, with a new year, to offer a little expanded opportunity, we hope this map currently shows our current new year seasons, and you'll notice there are counties that are uncolored with gaps in there. What we would propose is to add Sherman and Hansford counties, those two up in the three north part of the Panhandle against Oklahoma, and add that to the 16-day season, and then in the southwest Panhandle, add Gaines, Martin, and the eastern portion of Andrews County in the southwest Panhandle. And those counties, we believe, have new deer populations sufficient to allow the harvest of a few buck new deer, and that harvest would not have any effect on the overall new deer population or expansions in those counties. Next, we'd like to talk a little bit about the minimum draw weight for lawful archery equipment. What we have here is our current regulation that sets a minimum 40-pound peak draw weight. There are 14 states that still have a 40-pound draw weight requirement. There are 10 states that have gone to 35 pounds and 6 states to 30 pounds. 15 states have no draw weight requirement whatsoever. And we believe the trend is to a lighter draw weight, and going to a lighter draw weight or eliminating draw weight would probably increase the opportunity for younger people or people with smaller frames that maybe can't pull a 40-pound bow. And so this would increase bow hunting opportunity if we were to do that. It's also interesting that in 2004, the archery excise taxes, the 11% taxes collected on archery equipment that goes into the Pitt and Robinson program, it was modified to collect that only on bows of 30-pound draw weight or more. So bows, the lighter draw weight, like those used in the archery and school program, are not taxed for federal excise tax purposes. So as Larry talked about the other fishing, we could put this out there and see what folks would think. There are two ways, well, actually three. We could leave it alone and leave it at 40-pound in the draw weight. We could remove it altogether, or we could reduce the minimum peak draw weight requirement to 30 pounds for all legal archery equipment. The third item that we would be thinking about is a reduction of the minimum age for hunter education certification. And in accordance with the hunter education statute, the commission may establish the minimum age for participation in the program. The current minimum age is 12 that the commission set in 1988. The hunter education staff recommends lowering this age to 9 years of age so that it will be consistent with the Texas youth hunting program, which does allow youngsters 9 years of age. And also with the compatible with laws in several states that require proof of hunter education in order to hunt. In New Mexico, for example, they allow you to have a big game license at age 10, but you must demonstrate hunter education certification. And we would not issue that certificate until they were 12, even if they had taken it when they were younger. In this case, the instructors will be provided both pre-service and in-service training by partial hunter education staff that will help them better target and teach those younger students and their teaching now. And those are our three items. And
so the trend is toward a lower minimum age in several states.
Yes. There are many states, Colorado, I believe, requires hunter education certificate to anybody regardless of that.
Mike, one important question. I know it's on the tip of the tongue of the commissioners here. Is that 30-pound draw weight apply to catfish also?
It would apply any legal archery.
I'm sure that would come. I was real wondering here.
I would suggest you hold that question until Commissioner Montgomery returns.
I know he would want to know.
Any questions or discussion? Mike, thanks. Appreciate it. All right. Committee item number three, amendments to the statewide fur-bearing animal proclamation. Mr. John Young.
Chairman, committee members, my name is John Young. I'm a mammalogist within the Wildlife Division. We received over the past few months a couple of petitions for rulemaking. We're here today to go over the changes that we would ask your permission to propose in the federal register, the state register, for public comment. The changes that we're proposing are to lengthen the beaver season. This would effectively add 3 months of the beaver season, allowing folks to make commercial use of their beaver pelts over a longer time period. Changing our terminology within our regulations from the term lake hold, changing it to foothold, which is in keeping with the terminology that's being put forth by the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies through their best management practices for trapping, and to reduce the fee charges for non-resident wholesale fur dealers license from $600 to $250. And this is to try and attract some more non-resident fur dealers in Texas. Is there any questions?
Questions? Discussion? Okay. There are no further questions or discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Thank you. Committee item four, non-indigenous snake permit rules. Dan Sinclair.
Chairman and members, I'm David Sinclair, Chief of Wildlife Enforcement. I'm here today to request the commission to publish the non-indigenous snake hunting rules and the next question for the required Thursday public comment period. From the 80th Texas Legislature, Section 41 of House Bill 12 was enacted and it amended the Texas Parks and Wildlife Code. And requires the commission to establish permits for the recreation and commercial possession, transport of non-indigenous poison snakes and certain constrictions. In the regulation, we'll be referring to these snakes as controlled exotic snakes. They'll apply to all venomous snakes not indigenous to Texas, four species of pythons, and one minicomet. Two permit types will be the recreation. We allow the possession and transport, but not the sale. We're recommending a $20 fee. And the commercial control of exotic snake permits will allow the possession, transport, and sale. We're recommending a $60 fee.
Any
commercial permit required for each place of business for these snakes or so. Employees will be able to sell under that permit. Permittees must maintain a daily record of the commercial activities, either the name and address of those that they buy and sell from. The records must be kept for 2 years and made available on CWD's request for inspection by gang wardens or other authorized employees of the department. There's been some concern about someone walking in off the street and buying one of these snakes and not having a permit to possess or transport it. So what we're going to recommend is that the receipt that they get from that dealer will be valid for 21 days. It'll be the responsibility of the store owner of the permit to advise that the buyer that they must obtain the permit within the 21-day period. In closing, I'd like to mention just a couple of items about the new statute that will be of interest to you, I believe. The constrictors that they're referring to are the African rock python, the Asiatic rock, and sometimes called the Burmese python, reticulated python, Southern African python, and the green anaconda. There are some exceptions for the permit requirement. Slater County employees acting in their official duty would not need a permit. Licensed zoos and licensed research facilities, including universities that transport or possess persons to assist the department in handling or transportation of the existing species would not need a permit. A person that unlawfully possesses a listed snake is responsible for any costs incurred in the seizure, removal, and disposition of the snake. The department may contact the person who has expertise in handling these snakes to assist with the seizure, removal, and disposition. The permit will be made available by April 1st. That's one of the statutory requirements. Any regulation offense will be a Class C, partial life misdemeanor. Anyone that intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence or release or allows release of control of the exotic snake activity commits a Class A partial life misdemeanor. And with that, I'll close and be glad to answer any questions.
What about the life mom was going to cover?
Do we have any sort of tracking data on the number of people that this is involved in the type of snake? The only information that we have, there was several resource witnesses identified by the capital. There was one gentleman that suggested that there were 400,000 Texans who had at least one head reptile, 200,000 Texans who possessed at least one snake, and the majority of those were the constrictors, and then about 100,000 people with this would affect.
If I was going to go buy an anaconda, where do I
there are a lot of the pet stores and duties, and you can go online and you buy
them. What's our goal with this?
Several states are dealing with these large constrictors that have been released into the wild. Once old Bubba or whatever his name is gets to that point where he's going to wrap you up and drag you off to his home, people get rid of him. You know, they carry him out in the country and kick him out.
Yeah.
And Florida, for example, I'm sure you've all seen some of the car stories coming out of Florida and out of the airplanes where they've got more constrictors and anacondas there now that are eating alligators and deer and all of those things. So I think that was kind of behind a lot of this, as well as some of the, again, horror stories of
like run some really, really dangerous snakes. Population getting, a breeding population getting established. Have a, you know, tree snakes, you said, a variety of snakes around the world that have been introduced that have just taken over.
They think they're going to overrun the pan.
That's a for people.
Yeah, right.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, without further questions or discussion, I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Moving from snakes to deer, the committee item number 5, deer breeder permit and rules amendments. Cleveland.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, my name is Clayton Wolf. I'm the Big Game Program Director in the Wildlife Division. This afternoon, I'm going to present to you numerous proposed amendments to our to what is currently our scientific breeder permit rules. As a result of the passage of House Bill 1308 during the last legislative session, significant changes to what were our scientific breeder statutes, now called our deer breeder statutes. And because of those numerous changes, we are mandated to make changes to our rules, and also because of many of those changes, we're going to afford some opportunities to do some tweaking, if you will, to these rules, clean some stuff up, do some housekeeping. So I've got numerous changes here at this hour of the afternoon. I'd like to think it was stimulating, but it's not. I'm going to try to go as fast as possible through this.
Yeah, right.
Answer any questions as we go, but there is a lot of information here to go through. First, we propose to amend the permit name from scientific breeder permit to deer breeder permit, just to be consistent with the statute. And remove the term scientific from throughout the rules. We propose to submit the term to substitute the term deer breeder for a scientific breeder anywhere that it occurs throughout our rules. And we also propose to repeal provisions regarding the marking of deer. The old statute actually has provisions for tagging deer and also gave the department rulemaking authority for tattooing deer. The new statutes actually incorporated our old rules, and so the new statutes now have tagging requirements and tattoo requirements. And we are afforded no rulemaking authority when it comes to the marking of deer.
But that's, it's still there. It's just...
It's still there.
It's a different statute.
Basically, some of the tattoo requirements were in our regulations, and they're now in rule, but they are satisfactory.
Yeah.
We propose to substitute the term breeder deer anywhere deer occurs throughout the rule. Actually, these two terms are defined in statute. Deer being any white-tailed deer or mule deer, and then breeder deer being a subset of those that are being legally held under a breeder's permit. We need to propose to amend the antler removal criteria for deer that are liberated from a temporary facility, and by temporary facility, we typically mean a deer management permit pen. If those deer are released during the open season or 10 days prior to the open season. Currently there's a statute, the deer breeder statute requires that if a deer breeder releases a deer into the wild during an open deer season or 10 days prior to the open deer season, that they saw the antlers off. The old standard was sawing it off right at the base. The new standard is that they can saw it anywhere between the G3 tine and the base, and so that leaves a little bit of headgear on a deer that's released to defend itself, say, during the rut. The statute also says that if someone puts a deer in a deer management permit pen, that they don't have to remove the antlers. And so basically we have a rule now that requires that the antlers be removed if they're liberated from the pen into the wild. And we would simply amend the criteria to match statute so that if they do release a deer from a DMP pen during an open season, that they can saw it anywhere between the G3 tine and the base. We propose to repeal the prohibition for killing a deer in a deer breeding facility. We had this in a rule, and now the statute is a little clearer, but it does allow for a couple of exceptions that were not there before. It's still going to be a violation to kill a deer, say, for hunting purposes, in a deer breeding facility. But there are two exceptions. If a deer needs to be dispatched for humane purposes, say it's injured or diseased, that is allowed now by statute. And also, if disease testing needs to take place, for instance, CWD testing, or any other reportable disease, a breeder will be allowed to dispatch a deer for those purposes. We propose to repeal the violation for introducing wild deer into a breeding facility. This was a violation of the old statute. It isn't anymore. However, it still will be a violation to put wild deer in a breeding facility. Basically, the violation within our old statute was a Class C misdemeanor for introducing wild deer into a breeder pen. Now, with the repeal of that statute and with the repeal of this rule, if someone illegally traps deer from the wild for any purpose, then the Triple T statutes are enforced, and that's actually a Class D misdemeanor. So, we'll still repeal.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Back up on repeal of the prohibition of killing a deer in
yes,
deer breeding facility. What if a fellow has a deer breeding facility as like this, and he's got a fence down through here? It's all high fence, but he's got another fence here. If he puts a deer out in this part of his property, then can he shoot a deer or hunt it or?
The way the rules are established, when someone applies for a permit, they send us a diagram. So we know the perimeter of the facility. They cannot hunt a deer in that facility. They cannot kill a deer except for these two exceptions. Now, they can release a deer from that facility if they activate a fence for a permit. If they do it during an open deer season or 10 days prior to an open deer season, they have to solve and resolve. But once they release that deer, they can hunt that deer.
Even if it's high fence.
Yes. In fact, I would have to say the norm is usually if someone is releasing some of these animals that are fairly valuable, that they usually go into high fence pastures or ranches as opposed to just out to the open range. We also propose to repeal the definitions for common carrier, deer, propagation, scientific terms such as common carrier and scientific are no longer in the statute. The definition of propagation is self-evident, and as I said before, deer and breeder deer are now defined in statute, so there's not a need to redefine them in our rules. We propose to redefine sale to also include the activity of releasing a deer. The term sale is found throughout the breeder rules, but it simply refers to transfer or possession of an animal, and we just want to make it clear that also includes someone who buys a deer for release on their ranch. We propose to define accredited test facility to mean a laboratory approved by the United States Department of Agriculture for testing for chronic wasting disease. Right now, our rules require that test results come from the Texas Veterinary Medical Diagnostic Laboratory, but the reality is there are many facilities throughout the U.S. that are accredited at the same level, and we would propose to allow us to accept tests from any of these accredited facilities. We want to define or propose to define or actually redefine transfer permits, meaning a permit authorized for the movement of breeder deer to or from a breeding facility for release, nursing, or breeding purposes. Basically, this is just a retool of definition to more closely match the activities that are defined as transferring deer in the statute. We propose to clarify that no person may possess a live breeder deer outside a breeder facility unless they possess a valid transfer permit. And we'd also propose to repeal the requirement for a person to possess a permit to sell a deer. Basically, that would be a redundant rule because selling a deer would require a transfer permit, so there's no need to have a rule requiring a permit to sell a deer if you have to have one to transfer a deer. We propose to redefine unique number in our rules to match the statutory language that defines the requirements for tattooing a deer before it can leave a breeder facility. As I stated before, there are requirements in statute. Our reporting requirements ask that breeders report these numbers to us, and this would simply define that requirement as the unique number for that deer. The proposal simplifies the requirements for certified wildlife biologist endorsement of application materials. In actuality, what we are proposing is to remove the requirement for the endorsement of a breeding plan. The breeding plan requirement has been there for some time, but in actuality, we do not use a breeding plan for any purposes. I would want to make it clear that the statutes do still require that there be an endorsement, that endorsement, or with the combination of the statutes or the rules, if adopted, that endorsement would still require that a certified wildlife biologist endorse the facility, endorse that it exists, that it's suitable for conducting lawful activities, and that there are no deer in the facility before we issue a permit. We propose to repeal two requirements to notarize documents, that is the new application and also the escape deer notification. All of our documents of this nature require a signature attesting the truthfulness and accuracy of the documents, and they're really violations listed in the penal code for folks that falsify these kind of documents, so we feel that the notarization requirements are not necessary. We'd like to propose that applications for renewals be submitted in a timely manner or if the applicant is making satisfactory progress towards resolution of issues. We have deadlines, but also we understand that many times some of our applicants have some real-world scenarios that they have no control over, like deaths in the family, deaths of permittees, natural disasters occur. Our standard usually is as long as someone is making contact with us and progressing toward resolution of the issues, we're willing to consider that. If they're not responding to our request, then in all likelihood we will not renew their permit. We propose allowing an individual who does not possess a breeder permit to transport deer if they were obtained from a deer breeder, and if the person transporting the deer is in possession of a valid transfer permit. Previously, breeders could transport deer, a breeder's agent could transport deer, and then the only other person would be someone that was receiving a deer to release on their own property. And so we would like to expand that so that as long as someone has a valid transfer permit, they can move deer. We propose to repeal a requirement that the deer breeder maintain on request provided the department documentation as the source of all deer in possession. This is actually a change in statute. The new statute basically requires that they maintain records for the current reporting cycle and the previous reporting cycle. And in actuality, that is sufficient for us because all these records are turned into us on an annual basis, and with our new database, we have records of those transactions. We propose to clarify that breeder facility changes must be reported to the department only the changes to the perimeter of the facility. There seems to be a little bit of confusion out there as to what kind of changes we are looking for. And so this new definition just makes it a little clearer that if the perimeter does not change, we're really not concerned about new cross fences or facilities within that existing perimeter. And finally, we propose a few repeals within the rules relating to dates. One is a reference to a March 31st date that is now obsolete for the disease monitoring requirements, and also an effective date of April 1. Since this time has passed, the reference to these dates is no longer necessary in the rule. And we would like to propose to specify that May 23rd, 2006 is the effective date after which eligible mortalities are counted in reference to movement qualified status. And that concludes my slide. I would like to say that we have been working since the passage of the legislation with our breeder user group. This is an ad hoc group that is appointed by the executive director. It's made up of scientific breeders or agents that do a lot of business in the breeding industry, and we consult with them and get input from them to make sure that we understand the real world consequences of these rules. And today they're satisfied with these rules. We also presented these rules to our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee last week in San Antonio and received no comment, positive or negative, on them. I'll be glad to take any questions. Yeah.
Questions, comments?
Thanks, Clayton. Appreciate it.
No further questions or discussions. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period.
Item number six, amendments to the harmful or potentially harmful exotic fish, shellfish, or aquatic plant rules. Attorney Gray. Chairman, committee members, my name is Jody Gray, and I'm with the Inland Fisheries Division. The commission has established rules to regulate the importation, possession, sale, and placement in the water of the state any harmful or potentially harmful exotic fish, shellfish, or aquatic plants. Staff has proposed an amendment to these rules, which will provide additional protection for our native aquatic species and provide clarification to certain provisions of the rules. The current aquatic species rules allow possession and sale and culture of silver carp with the possession of a valid aquatic species permit from the department. Silver carp are native to rivers in China, are prohibited because of their potential escapement and successful reproduction in Texas. Silver carp have already escaped and successfully reproduced in the U.S. waters. And as a matter of fact, this has been documented on a DVD, which is entitled Extreme Aerial Bow Fishing, in which silver carp was shot out of the air on the Illinois River.
Oh, something new we can do. Yeah, right? We aren't going to say anything, Bill.
On July 10, 2007, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Silver Carp is our list of injured fish under the Lake Act. Consequently, staff is proposing the total prohibition of all forms of live silver carp. On October 18, 2007, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service added black carp to their list of injured fish. The department currently allows possession of turquoise black carp with a valid exotic species permit. Staff is therefore proposing total prohibition of all forms of livestock harvesting. At the August 2006 commission meeting, the commission adopted rules prohibiting possession of all southern hemisphere crayfish, which included crayfish in the family pack capacity. Because there were individuals already selling Australian red carp crayfish, which is in the Paraspathy family, staff intended to allow the live possession of this one species. Our current rules, however, allow the possession of all crayfish in the family past staff. Staff is proposing that the rules be amended to reflect staff's initial intent. Staff seeks approval to publish the proposed amendments in effect. Discussion or questions?
Yes, ma'am. So on the crayfish, you're saying you still allow the Australian red claw crayfish?
Right.
What's the,
right now,
what does the pad do?
We'll say that any crayfish in that family can be cultured. Want to limit it to that one Australian red carp. But we initially were going to prohibit all southern hemisphere crayfish, but we found out that there were people cultured already. In Texas, so to allow them to continue business, we allow that one species to continue to be cultured. But the rules that are published allow all species in the family to continue to be cultured. We just want to limit it to that one.
But I guess why allow the one? How? Risky is it or dangerous is it if it gets released and ends up the coast? Then why are we allowing it?
The question is why would we allow the right to one?
Yeah, the one.
Because of it, I guess there were five or six different farmers at that time that were cultivating, and we didn't know that. And at the time we proposed the rules, we didn't think anybody was cultivating in Texas. And those businesses were already established. And we had comments on the Australian Tennessee and it's a trade issue.
Well, we chose to consume grandfathers as a producer. That's something that I'm thinking back to.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous.
Because I remember your presentation about that particular species being potentially a contamination pass.
Right.
That was the first stand because not just this invasive aquatic species, just sort of like wildlife.
Better understand how established is it?
Yeah, not
how many people are doing it?
You know, I don't know how, for the record, my name is Phil DeRocher, director of Fisheries. I don't know how long these people have been producing in this state. You know, we had some issues with a former a plant that we were concerned about it, and we found out that they grew it in Houston for years and years and selling it in the Asian market, and it had not caused any problem. They found out, they hadn't found any spread of the plant, so, but we'll certainly prohibit it if you want to. I would just go do it now before it gets any bigger.
That's what we're, that'd be my preference.
No, I'm trying to understand. You're going to have some people come here and
well, we've got a public comment period, so I think we should go ahead and do it.
And then we can always,
brought for the committee.
Yeah.